Hi there. Welcome to another episode of the Overstated NBA Show. That's right. I'm back. Ethan Lane, Timberwolves fan, Rudy Gobert apologist. And as you know, I'm already geared up for another play-in tournament championship this year. We find ourselves on the eve of another NBA season. Another notch in the belt of the association following some turbulent time off, some FIBA fracas, a plethora of Austin Reeves propaganda, and we are getting ready to tip off the regular season in less than 3 weeks' time. Now, since the last time I graced your Bluetooth, aux cable, or web browser, and I'm choosing not to count that reunion pod we did last week since I was basically a fly on the wall for the vast majority of that episode, we've seen a seemingly historic draft, prospects cutting their teeth at the Thomas and Mack Center in Las Vegas, a free agency period that lacked some of the normal shock factor that has been present in years past, and the ending of a surprisingly cordial hostage crisis that has shaken the foundation of the Eastern Conference, so much so that the teams, at least in my power rankings, fell in pretty much the exact same order. So that's why I'm here. You're probably asking yourself, where's Steve? Where's Brett? Where's our infamous producer, Mikey? Is Adler back? Is this the B-Team podcast glorious return? Nope. As of right now, it's just me. Down the road, we're going to have some cycling of assorted guests, some friends of the program, and I'm hoping and praying that Christian Brown will open my DMs and respond. I've been trying for months to no avail. But this is it. Steve, Brett, and Mikey are the stars of the show. My plan is to go where I'm wanted, to produce when available, to fill the gaps where they're needed. And effectively, I'm the spot-up guy in the corner of the overstated universe. So to kick off the 78th trip around the sun for the NBA, I'm on season preview patrol. Six divisions, six episodes, six friends of the overstated, coming to make the case for their squad to come out on top while providing what I hope will be an incredibly insightful, albeit moderately biased look at their chances of raising a Larry O'Brien trophy in just short eight short months. Wow. My first stutter back on the podcast sphere. Here we go. First of many. Let's get after it. So tonight, we're going to kick off the Atlantic Division, and I'm joined by a Massachusetts resident, a self-proclaimed sultan of the sportsbook, and a man that I've given $20 to in each of the past 2 years, and he's been kind enough to send me back $240 in return. Back-to-back fantasy football champ. He's my commissioner. He's the musical talent behind our podcast intro as part of Snowmelt. He is Matthew Sullivan. Matt, welcome to the Overstated NBA Show. How are you doing, buddy?
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. I'm very excited to be here. I'm obviously a huge fan of the Overstated in general. I like to lurk a little more than post in regards to the actual, you know, Facebook group, but the chats, I tend to be a little more lively and excited about talking and stuff like that, you know, especially the fantasy football chat. Our buddy Ethan here is the two-time champion, as he stated, and we'll see if he can go for the triple crown.
Respectfully, my team sucks this year.
You're kind of struggling. My team's not great. Currently, me and Aaron are actually tied 2-2 with the exact same points, which is shocking. Like, I've never been tied with the exact same points to the decimal point with anyone in fantasy football.
Oh, man. Well, everybody loves the fantasy football chat on their basketball podcast. But, you know, like, as you know, last year I was in the semifinals and I ended up tying in a semifinal matchup on three consecutive Justin Herbert kneel downs. So I've seen my fair share of ties. Sometimes they break your way. And that's the great thing about the NBA. You don't have to have these tiebreakers. You get overtime. You get after it. You play till exactly. You win. And that's the fantastic part of this league. So I'm excited that you're here tonight, Matt. I mentioned to a couple of people that I needed a rational Boston sports fan to talk to in terms of your outlook for the season. Obviously, Derek's been on the show before. It's interesting to get a second perspective coming from a Bostonian glance. And I'm excited to talk to you about not just the Celtics tonight, but the Atlantic Division as a whole.
Sure. Yeah, I'm ready. I am ready. I've done my research.
Heck yeah. Well, that makes one of us. So let's kick it off. Last season, the Atlantic Division, all five teams finished at 500 or above. Obviously, at the bottom of that division, was still a respectable record was the Toronto Raptors, but they still finished at 500 of 41-41. All four of those five teams made the playoffs, with the Raptors faltering in that play-in matchup with the Chicago Bulls. And this year, I think that there's going to be a little bit more separation in how these teams kind of stack up, whether that's because of trades that they've made recently, the signings they made over the offseason, the signings they didn't make this offseason. And I want to start with the Boston Celtics tonight. So the Boston Celtics coming into this season, they're the favorites in the Eastern Conference, at least to win the conference, according to DraftKings Sportsbook. Right now, they're projected at an over-under of 55.5 wins. They're at minus 280 to win their division. They're at +180 for the conference, and they're a 4-1 favorites to win the title and cut down the Nets at the end of the season. So I want to start with this. Obviously, we've seen the Jrue Holiday trade. Steve, Brett, and Mikey touched on that in our last episode. And the big thing for me is the additions that they made to the team versus the people that went out on the way. I did a little graphic to kind of kick things off. To come into this season, they add Jrue Holiday in that recent trade with Portland. They added Kristaps Porzingis in that trade with Washington that said Marcus Smart to the Grizzlies. They draft a kid in Jordan Walsh who haunted my dreams after he kicked Kansas out of the tournament this last March Madness here. They add my guy, Svi Mykhailiuk, speaking of Kansas. They just signed Wenyen Gabriel to a training camp deal. Not sure if he's going to make the official roster. But you lose four guys, at least three of them, that have been the better part of a Boston franchise for the vast majority of Mazzulla's tenure, Yudoka's teams, and even going back to when Brad Stevens was still coaching. You lose Marcus Smart. You lose Time Lord Rob Williams. You lose Grant Williams. And you lose Malcolm Brogdon. So, Matt, how are you feeling as you come into this new season? A lot of new faces in the locker room, albeit you might have a little bit more talent, especially when it comes to Holiday and Porzingis. But how do you overcome the loss of those big culture guys?
Sure. So I am just want to point out that I am very excited for this season. I love the additions, but I am very sad about the losses because, I mean, as any Celtics fan knows, Marcus Smart is the heart and soul of the Celtics the past, you know, since he's been a Celtic, he's been the heart and soul. He is the vocal leader. We do not have a vocal leader now. Jason Tatum has to be that guy now, and we need him to really step up. Jaylen Brown just doesn't come off like that to me. He's never going to be a vocal leader in my eyes. And, you know, we lost another guy in Grant Williams who, you know, a lot of Celtics fans did not like Grant Williams last year and shat on him a lot. But he is one of the best defenders on the Celtics versus the key guys in our key opponents. Like he's probably our second best Giannis defender after Al Horford. He is our second best Embiid defender actually after Al Horford. And notice that I didn't mention that Rob Williams was good versus those bigs because he's not. Rob Williams played 35 games last year and a lot of times in the playoffs really struggled to like stay on the court because he cannot, you know, guard these bigs, like, you know, Bam even just like really struggling with these bigs and just doesn't really produce like you want. So I am actually, I really liked Rob Williams. I think he's a really solid player. He's a great shot blocker, but I am less sad about him than I am Marcus big time. And I honestly think Grant actually might be somewhat a little more important just in the grand scheme of defensive scheme in the Eastern Conference for this reason. And I just, with Rob Williams, you know, replace him with Kristaps Porzingis, who averages way more points a game, played 65 games last year. I know he's super injury prone, but since Rob's been in the league, Kristaps Porzingis has played 210 games. Guess how much Rob has played? 209. So he's played one less game than the person we think of in the NBA as the most injury prone guy, you know, and he's played less games than him. And he, you know, he played 30 something games last year. So I like the addition of Kristaps. I think we really need that offensive prowess because that's, I know we were second in offensive rating last year, but you could see it in the game. And a lot of the games we lost, and, you know, we lost some really bad games. Like we lost a huge comeback win with Brooklyn against us. And we struggled in the second halves a lot to put up points. And I just really worry about that. And I think the addition of Jrue Holiday, you know, who averaged 19 points a game last year is huge. And I think the addition of Porzingis, who averaged, you know, a lot of points last year, like he, you know, it all adds up. And I think we got worse on defense, honestly, even with Jrue Holiday being a better defender than Marcus Smart. But we did get slightly worse without Grant. And I will say that I think a lot of people will disagree with my love for Grant. And that's about that for what I got to start.
Well, you definitely gave me a lot to cook with. I do want to start with the addition of Porzingis. Obviously you talked about his comparative availability versus having a guy like Rob Williams on the court. I think just going from A to B, at least in that aspect, obviously Porzingis, a massive upgrade, at least in terms of what you're able to do with him on the floor comparatively with Rob Williams. So the things that I worried about when you had a guy like Rob, and it's a thing that I deal with when I have a guy like Rudy Gobert on my team, is you worry, at least in the modern NBA, about the spacing that your team can provide. And I Obviously, you could do the best to try and scheme to alleviate some of those spacing issues. But I think when you have a guy like Porzingis, you don't only have that ability to stretch the floor offensively with his ability to knock down shots, with his ability to keep people honest along the perimeter, something that Rob was never really able to do. But even on defense, too, like you have a little bit more switchability. You have the ability now to play with these bigger lineups that you can kind of trot out there. Like you can play Horford and Porzingis off of each other really, really easily. And like you said, people have talked about how you lost your Giannis stopper, you lost your Embiid stopper. Horford's been that guy for the vast majority of his tenure with the Celtics. He's been that guy who's matched up against those big stars, your Giannis's, your Embiid's. If the Cavs take a step this year and you have to start worrying about like an Evan Mobley or a Jared Allen in the playoffs, these are the kinds of people that you're going to be seeing as you move through the regular season, especially when you get into the playoffs. And obviously, you talk about health, and obviously health, a big subject for any team. Let's play devil's advocate here. Let's say we get into a scenario where Kristaps goes down and you have to worry about him for a stretch being gone 25, 30 games. Where do you see this team sort of go to as the next man up mentality? Do they play the small ball position that they did last year with Horford at the five and Tatum at the four? Do you really lean on a guy like Jordan Walsh, a 6'7 rookie out of Arkansas who has been lauded for his defensive chops? And we saw that both in summer league, and it's probably the major reason why he was drafted. What's your mentality as a Celtics fan if you see the injury happen that you've kind of been accustomed to with that big man position? What happens with this year's roster?
I mean, we saw it last year with Rob Williams playing so little games, and we were okay for the most part, because Al can really step up and play center when he wants to, you know, when he needs to. And say a Jordan Walsh type can actually get minutes and stay on the floor and, you know, be a good defensive player, then that pretty much is it. I mean, that's all you got to do. Like Luke Kornet is not the answer. Luke Kornet sucks. Luke Kornet is not a good player. The Kornet contest is a joke. I am a Celtics fan, and I know everyone had fun with that last year, but it's a joke. But Jordan Walsh is the key to me because he is a defensive ready player in the NBA. You know, obviously we saw in in summer league, you know, that first game, he actually hit some big shots. You know, he was shooting three pretty well and stuff like that. I think he had four threes in that first game when I watched them. And if he can be a 3-and-D kind of like four, if you will, then that would be huge because he can guard big people. Like he can guard if Horford's not on the floor, he can guard like a Bam Adebayo. Like I think Bam will, you know, do pretty well against him, but as a rookie, but I still think he has the potential to be someone that actually can guard a, you know, players bigger than him just because of his frame and everything. He's jacked, guy's ripped.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that's going to be one of your biggest steps because I look at the rest of your bench kind of up and down the line, and I kind of want to save Peyton Pritchard for last because I do want your thoughts on him, especially with the guard rotation being adjusted a little bit. He's going to need to step up and do a little bit more on the offensive side of things. But, I mean, you look at Sam Hauser. I feel like I know what Sam Hauser is. Svi Bacalic, I love the man to death. Loved watching him at Kansas. I basically know what he is. I mean, like, your bench for me doesn't spark joy. And I feel like that's kind of been the thing that's lamented you, at least for the past couple of years, like outside of your top six. And just like Brett said on the podcast, our last episode here, your top six on paper is without a doubt, I'd say probably one of the top three in the league, if not the number one top six on paper. But again, like it's going to come down to those guys that you need to take the next step. And I guess that brings me to Peyton Pritchard. Where do you see him fitting into with this role? And obviously I've seen all the discourse from the last couple of seasons with him being, I don't want to say buried. I think that's a wrong word, but when you have had as many guards last year at that position, getting those minutes, whether it was Marcus Smart or Derek White or Malcolm Brogdon, you have a guy in Peyton Pritchard who would be asked to come in moments where they need offense. And when anybody comes in, when they have a bunch of do not play coaches decisions on their resume, at least for that season, where do you see his next development going? Do you think he can be that change of pace guard that you can bring off the bench?
Yeah. So just to, you know, first, but we haven't even talked about the fact that we lost Malcolm Brogdon, who was the sixth man of the year last year. So that's obviously a bigger loss. You know, he was a really solid regular season player for us. Obviously in the playoffs, he was playing a little injured and he really struggled in the playoffs. And I'm sad to see him go, but Peyton Pritchard can be offensively what Malcolm Brogdon can be offensively in my eyes. He's arguably, you know, a better three-point shooter, you know, on paper. I mean, Brogdon actually was a pretty efficient three-point shooter last year, but in pure talent and like raw talent, Peyton Pritchard can shoot the hell out of the ball. He really can. And what I think is actually going to happen is they're going to kind of stagger Derek White and Drew Holiday a little bit. And probably they could easily start both of them, but then just like have someone kind of go out a little earlier and then bring in like a Pritchard and Hauser and stuff like that. And that should alleviate some of the issues with the second unit, just having one of those starting worthy guards playing with the second unit for the most part. And then they can kind of stagger the second unit with those two players. And I think that would really actually help the second unit a ton. But Peyton Pritchard is a sieve on defense. He really is. He's an awful defender. And that's what worries me most about Peyton Pritchard is he can really score, but he really can't guard anyone. And Hauser, you know, he tries on defense. He's not a good defender. Like the second unit defensively is really bad. And that's what really worries me about this team is I don't see really a case for the second unit to, you know, really typically outscore most teams second unit, but also mostly because they can't really defend the second unit, you know?
I feel that for sure. Yeah, I look up and down this roster. I don't think you guys are going to repeat in your sixth man of the year sort of tenure here. Obviously, Derek White, big loss, big loss. But again, like you're not relying on your bench guys all the time, right? You're relying on your starters, your Jason Tatums, your Jaylen Browns, your guys who pretty much, at least at points during the playoffs last year, led you single-handedly to a conference finals. Like, if you don't have Jason Tatum in Game 6 and Game 7 last year doing what he did on the offensive end of the floor against Philly, you're looking at another second-round exit, and maybe Mazzulla's on a little bit more of a hot seat than he may be going into this year. I do want to touch on Mazzulla a little bit. And this is actually fantastic timing. I was in the car on my way home from work, and I'm looking for something to listen to. I've got a 30-minute commute. I get a lot of podcast and drive time in every day going to and from work. And I pull up JJ Redick's podcast, and lo and behold, there's a podcast with Joe Mazzulla sitting right waiting for me. And I want your thoughts on Coach Maz, because I didn't know too much about him going into listening to this today. I knew him from his time at West Virginia, being a Big 12 basketball fan. I was the angriest I've ever been at a human last season after he sprinted past half court and basically ran into a referee to call timeout in a matchup with the Timberwolves that should have been a technical foul, but they decided to give him the timeout. They pull out the win at the end. After that podcast, I listened to what he said, and the level of self-awareness that he had in that interview with JJ gave me a lot of respect for the guy. Like, you're a fourth assistant on one of the best teams in the NBA, and not just one of the best teams in the NBA, a team with a cultural significance and the legacy that the Boston Celtics have. And then the Ime Udoka stuff comes out. You see Will Hardy get hired away from the team, and all of a sudden, a guy with some Division II coaching experience, some Division One coaching a little bit on the side, some G League head coaching experience, gets thrust into arguably one of the biggest jobs in the NBA. And he tapped his own chest in that interview, and he basically said, like, there are parts of the game that I wasn't ready for. He talked about how he used to sneak in through the service entrance to and from work and only talk to the players that he was really working with. He's forced to be this massive extrovert and to be the face of one of the biggest teams in all of sports. And that level of self-awareness was really huge for me. I want to ask you, like, what do you want to see from Joey Mazz as he steps into his second full year, having a full training camp, having an off season with his players, and ultimately being forced into like a far more extroverted role than I think he was really prepared to do last season? What do you want to see from him going forward?
Yeah. So first off, I just want him to be a more vocal leader. Like I mentioned before, we need more vocal leaders than just the whole team, because the first half of the year, he was just coasting on the court. I don't think he was ready for the moment, but he was just letting the players do their thing, letting the players play, wasn't calling timeouts when needed. He was just letting everything just unfold in front of him. And you saw it kind of going towards the playoffs that he was getting a little more vocal. He was getting a little more aggressive, because one thing about Joe Mazzulla is he's a basketball sicko. Like, that guy loves basketball. He really, really loves basketball. And he really wants to be a great coach. And I honestly had a lot of problems with him last year. I did not like him for pretty much almost the entire regular season. I thought he was a bad coach. He kind of reminded me of like Jason Garrett, like Cowboys coach, just like kind of coasting on the sideline, just letting things happen and just, you know, like clapping along, you know, chewing his gum. But I did see some growth coming into the playoffs where he was a little more vocal. You know, he started calling timeouts when needed, which is, a huge part of coaching is actually just like stopping a run, you know, which he just wouldn't do. He wouldn't stop runs from the other team. He just wouldn't stop them at all. So I'd like to see that mostly. I do like the fact that he got to bring in some of his own staff. So he has guys underneath him and with him now that, you know, look to him for coach. And I think just having just the total authority actually builds your confidence as a coach in general. So, I mean, that's pretty much all I got in Missoula. I hope the best for him. I am still very, very hesitant with Missoula. I did not love him most of last year, but I do think he was thrown into the fire a little bit, and I will give him a break just because, you know, we still won 57 games last year, even with like some of those, you know, bad coaching techniques.
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned his coaching staff too. Like the guys that he brought in to fill out his bench in the assistant coaching roles are just tailor-made to help him, I think, succeed as a head coach more this year. You bring in a guy like Sam Cassell, who was a serviceable NBA player for years and years and years, and then had multiple tenures in assistant coaching around the league. I know he was working on Ty Lue's staff for the Clippers as well. Big Sam Cassell guy, especially as a Minnesota fan. You bring in a guy like Charles Lee. Charles Lee was being considered for head coaching jobs around the association. Now he ends up being the second assistant for Joe Mazzulla. And as much as I have been indoctrinated to hate a guy like Phil Pressey just because of the college he went to, shout out Mizzou or whatever the opposite of a shout out is, like, Phil Pressey's a really good player. Like, he's been in the organization for a really long time, obviously helping coach the team that brought him in and drafted him way back when. That's that level of growth that I think you need to see, kind of to your point. Like, he brings in guys that will help the skills that he doesn't have, whether that's being an introvert or whether it's being potentially aggressive with players. Like, he can look at Sam Cassell and say, hey, go do that for me. Like, I think that's where he can really focus on his strengths and sort of alleviate a lot of the concerns that he had last year. But again, to your point of stop and runs, every new coach goes through that. Like, the amount of times I would shout at Chris Finch in his first 2 years as a Wolves coach, like, he didn't know when to call a timeout. The third quarters were especially terrible. Like, he would just let teams go on runs and runs and runs. And I'm just like, Chris, what are you saving these timeouts for? He's starting to learn those things. And again, like, if you haven't listened to it, or if anybody who's listened to this hasn't listened to that JJ Redick pod with Joe Mazzulla, go listen to it. It changed my thoughts on him as a coach. It kind of humanized him a little bit for me, and it makes it a lot more interesting to hopefully root for the Celtics a little bit more than I would originally be able to.
One thing he said recently, I think the other day, was that he doesn't want to shoot 50 plus threes a game now, which is really nice to hear. He wants to do it. Like, he said pretty much, if that's what the defense gives us, you know, and we do it and succeed, that's great. But he does not want to be like the 50 plus 3-point shooting team anymore, like, which is a huge problem with us, because we went on so many cold streaks shooting last year. Even, you know, we obviously won a lot of games, but we went on a lot of cold streak shooting where we should have won more games.
Absolutely. And yeah, you're going to make those adjustments your second year as a coach. And obviously, as you start to bring in a guy like Jrue Holiday and Porzingis, you can space the floor. But again, like, you can have those possessions where, like, hey, we're going to post up Porzingis for 5 seconds, or hey, we're going to slow down the pace of play, and we're not just worried about chucking the ball up for a three and getting back on defense. You can slow that pace of play down. You don't need to have a billion possessions every game. Obviously, in some games, you need to do that to stay ahead or in order to keep the pace up. But you can afford to slow down a little bit more, I think, with this year's roster, as opposed to last year's, where it was really just running the floor, constantly trying to out cardio people. Now you can start to work a little bit more on technique and organizing some of your own structure that I think he didn't really get the chance to do last year, considering when he was hired. All right, so that wraps up my thoughts on Boston. I want to transition to maybe a more dramatic turn here, and I want to talk about the Philadelphia 76ers. Or over under win totals 49.5. So another 50 win season for a team that got rid of Doc Rivers and brought in a championship coach, Nick Nurse, for his first season at the helm. They're plus 350 to win the division, plus 750 for the conference, which, given the odds, might not be the worst bet in the world. They're 18-1 to win the title. They bring in some role guys. They kind of keep that same core, and obviously we're going to talk about James Harden in just a bit here, but they bring in guys like Patrick Beverley, who I think is going to really help set the culture for them a little bit more. They bring in a guy like Kelly Oubre, who he's been on a kind of a litany of teams that are just kind of using him for empty counting stats, whether it was those early Suns days or whether it was his time with Charlotte. But another Kansas guy, I got to pay my respect to him. Love the guy. GQ magazine, ready. Get him on the cover any chance you get. They bring in Danny Green for some locker room stuff, but they lost some shooting off the bench. George Niang, a guy who terrified me as a Big 12 basketball fan for 4 years. They lose Shake Milton to my Timberwolves. I am more than happy to bring him into the fold. And Jalen McDaniels went to their divisional rival, the Raptors. How do you see Philly? Obviously, they flamed out in round two to your Boston Celtics. They had a lot of fanfare and vitriol going into that playoffs with Embiid winning the MVP. They seem to be firing on all cylinders, but a change needed to be made. Is James Harden that change? Does he need to leave Philly in order for them to kind of see their potential, depending on what the return on that trade would be? Or do you think he's going to basically end the season there and we're looking for more of the same in terms of a 50-win team that makes some noise in the playoffs, but not enough to make it to the finals?
Yeah, James Harden's a tricky one. So my thought is if he starts the year with them, I mean, he's likely to finish because how many teams are actually going to want James Harden this year? I mean, unless he just starts having this like wonderful regular season and, you know, like the Clippers or someone are looking for him because, you know, they obviously were interested in him this offseason anyways. But I don't think a lot of teams are going to want to trade big prospects or draft picks for James Harden at this point. So I honestly see him finishing the season if he plays 20 games. I think he finishes the season there. And with that being said, they're a 50 win team at the least in my eyes, because Embiid. So in the past 5 years, the only two seasons in the past five where Philly has not reached 50 games, 50 wins, it was because Embiid only played 51 games each. So if Embiid plays over 60 games and Harden, you know, is regular season Harden, then they should win 51, 52, 53 games in my eyes. And they could even contend in this, you know, contend with the Celtics. Even I do think the Celtics are a better team and we have plenty of people that can guard their guys, except really, you know, I mean, obviously Al's old, but you know, it's tricky at this point whether he can guard Embiid, but he did last year and he did fine. But they're at least a regular season, I think they're a 50 plus win team, and I actually think Niang is a bigger loss than people would think, because I think he's a fantastic shooter and he really puts in good minutes for them. So I don't really like that. Oubre is a good addition though in my eyes. I know you're a fan, but I'm a fan of Oubre as well. Not only is he, you know, extravagant looking, but he's a bucket, you know, he's kind of a bucket player. So I think he could replace some of that Niang, those Niang points, and be even a little more dynamic of a player in general than Niang. So I think they're a 50 win team, and I think they come in second in the Atlantic Division.
I could see them coming in second. I could also see them with a couple of balls bounce the wrong way. I could see them coming in first. Like I looked primarily at the guys that they brought in, and obviously I'm a big college player. So like everybody that they brought in, at least to their training camp roster, I loved in college. I loved Tre'Quavion Smith. I loved Ricky Council. He killed Kansas early in that game as well. They brought in Tubelis. Obviously these guys are going to spend time in the G League, but at least as far as like guys that you can have in your system and either have on two ways or using your farm system and kind of stash them for a rainy day, I think those are like phenomenal guys to bring in. And the big thing for me, obviously, yeah, too, like Harden has kind of like boxed himself into a position where like I don't think anybody, like you said, I don't think anybody really wants him. Like I hate to call him like a bigger version of the D'Angelo Russell situation, but you look around the league and you look for guys who are looking for ball dominant point guards who are going to be taking double digit shots every single game. There's not a lot of room for any of those players. Like I feel like you either have somebody who is the centerpiece of a team, where obviously you don't want James Harden coming in. Like the one that comes to mind, like you won't want to see him on a team like Charlotte, where you want to take the ball out of LaMelo's hands. You don't want to take him anywhere else that you have like a really ball dominant point guard, but you also don't want him on a team like Houston, where Udoka kind of soured on him, at least according to a report I saw earlier today, where like he wants to go for a scoring title again. And he doesn't want to. And if you're a coach, you don't want him taking the ball out of your young players' hands and really stymieing that development. So I feel like he's really boxing himself into a corner unless a team like the Clippers comes along. But again, like it's a situation like where Miami thought that they were with the Damian Lillard contract, where they're really only gambling against themselves, that there's really no motivation to sort of up your own bid because you are the only bid in town, at least to your own knowledge. But like on the flip side of like trying to compare this to the Lillard contract, you can obviously do a lot more with Damian Lillard on your roster than you could do with a guy like James Harden. So I feel like you said, he's in a box. I think if he starts the season with Philly, there were reports that he was going to cause some sort of scene when he showed up for training camp, but apparently he was very, very amicable and just went through the motions. He's talking to guys about determination and hustle. I think he's going to be on the team for the year, but I don't know, again, like, I don't know if that really increases Philly's ceiling by having Harden for one more year, or if we get through the season and things start to maybe not go as well, or he still continues his kind of rhetoric of, I don't want to deal with Daryl Morey anymore, a guy who's been responsible for the vast majority of his NBA paychecks. I don't really know where Philly goes from here.
Yeah. No, totally. Harden just, he can't get out of his own way sometimes. Like this whole, like, you know, Russillo called him a legendary quitter on his pod this week, which was awesome. Just like he's a quitter. And we see not even just like quitting on teams, but he quits in games. I mean, we saw it in the playoffs this year. He had those two amazing games versus the Celtics, and then he was a no-show the other games. He was a disaster the other games. He had two really good, wonderful, classic James Harden games where everyone was like, shit, this is not good for the Celtics. Celtics fans were real worried about that. And then he just flamed out the rest of the games aside from those two. So he's a quitter in the game. He's a quitter on teams. He's just a quitter. I don't like James Harden. But with that being said, regular season James Harden is going to win you plenty of games, especially with Embiid, with Maxey, who we haven't even mentioned yet. I love Maxey. I think he's a tremendous player. He's a good bucket. I think their ceiling is Eastern Conference Finals to me. I don't think they can beat a Celtics or Bucks in the Eastern Conference Finals, but that's their ceiling. I don't see them as a championship contender at all. We've just seen them for so long now with these type of players and this type of system. It just doesn't bode success like on the grand scheme of things. So I see them as a great regular season team that will flame out in the playoffs once again.
So I wanted to get your thoughts on this as well, and then we'll kind of move on for the Sixers here too. Like, again, like you say, like their ceiling is limited. You say that they're not a finals team, even at their current construction. At what point, and again, like I don't want to start, I hate starting rhetorics of when teams are, or when players are going to ask out of their teams. Obviously, I've dealt with it a little bit on my own because everyone says that Karl Anthony Towns should get traded or should ask for his way out. Now that Anthony Edwards plays like 17 games with Team USA, now everyone's saying that he's just going to ask his way out and ask for a bad contract. And that's kind of the small market malaise that I deal with on a regular basis. But if you're Joel Embiid, if you get to the end of the season, what, if anything, do you decide to do? Obviously, beloved by the city of Philadelphia, obviously a massive personality. I'd say he's probably their biggest sports talent that they have. I'd say it's probably him and Harper for the Phillies, at least in terms of like their cultural relevancy to the city of Philly, at least for now. I feel like Jalen Hurts or some of the other Eagles are close, but right now it's Joel and Bryce. I don't think he asks out. Do you think there's any chance that he maybe looks at it at the end of this season and says, maybe I want to seek greener pastures? Is that's kind of the NBA we're in right now?
That's the thing, is it's the NBA we are in right now. We've seen it so many times in the past 10 seasons. You know, it's part of the culture now. And, you know, I don't necessarily love it as a fan, but I'm also not the type that wants to tell someone what, you know, where they want to live and what they want to do with their job necessarily. So I don't really like that. I guess I don't really know where to go with it, because I could totally see him doing it. Like I really can. He's a sourpuss guy. Like he's a big personality, but he's a big sourpuss. Like when they lose, like he gets real sour. And that, like we saw him blaming Ben Simmons and stuff like that, you know? And you know, you can clearly tell he didn't like Doc. So it just like, there's so much potential for it, I guess, because he's such a sourpuss in general.
So Give me a straight answer. Obviously, we need to, I've said no. I don't think he's going to leave at the end of the season or throughout. Does Joel Embiid ask for his way out at the end of this year? Your thoughts?
I'm going to say no. No.
Okay. Perfect. That's what I need. I like straightforward answers. That's what I need.
All right. Sorry.
I can't nail down Steve or Brett on anything. I need a straight yes or no. I'm black or white. That's what I need. All right. Let's move on. Let's talk the New York Knicks. Or should I say the New Age Villanova Wildcats? They have signed everyone from my favorite team, with the exceptions of Eric Paschal and Jay Wright, to coach the team itself. They bring in guys like Dante DiVincenzo to reunite with Jalen Brunson, to reunite with Josh Hart, who they re-signed. They bring in, they bring in Ryan Arcidiacono, another guy from that Villanova class. They lose Obi Toppin, but they end up signing his brother Jacob to a two-way. So Toppin in, a Toppin out, depending on where you go. Tibbs and Rose finally part ways. Derrick Rose landing on his feet as that third guard for the Memphis Grizzlies. We'll see if he gets any sort of time. I doubt that he does. More of a mentorship role probably for him. But their over-under is 45.5. They're 9-1 to win the division. They're 50-1 to win the title. New York basketball is back, but I feel like they're still missing something. Matt Sullivan, in your eyes, what are they missing?
Absolutely. So they're missing players that can play in the postseason, aside from Jalen Brunson. And I like a guy like Mitchell Robinson, and I really like Josh Hart. But they, two of their top three guys are Julius Randle and RJ Barrett, who are ghosts in the playoffs. And they're honestly two of my least favorite players in the entire NBA. And statistically, the Knicks are better when RJ Barrett is off the floor, which is crazy because he's supposed to be their third best player. And Julius Randle is just, he is so ball dominant for, you know, a forward. He's so ball dominant for a forward, and he takes so many bad shots. You know, his obviously, you know, regular season last year, he was fantastic, but we all saw in the playoffs, he was a disaster. He was a disaster for that team in the playoffs. Jalen Brunson was the reason, you know, they had any success in the playoffs. And I like Mitchell Robinson as a great center defender, but I liked Dante DiVincenzo to kind of give them some buckets, and he can actually play some defense. I like him. But they need a guy like Quickly to really, you know, grow into another year. Obviously we saw him, you know, when Brunson was out, have some great success. He did against the Celtics even, but he needs to step up big time, and they really need some players. Cause I don't think like losing Obi Toppin is a big deal at all, because he barely played. He played 11 minutes per game. I totally thought they underutilized him. I actually like Obi Toppin. But I think they are a low ceiling team in the playoffs, but I will say I will happily be betting their over games, because they won 47 games last year, and I actually think they're better this year with even just barely doing anything in the offseason. The over under is 45.5, and I see them being like a 48-49 win team.
So that's interesting. I didn't really expect you to go that way, because I look at the other teams in the Eastern Conference that have made big moves. Your Indiana's, your Cleveland's, your Washington's to a point. Obviously, maybe they're not on the same tier as maybe some of these other guys, but you look at what they did, and at least they did something. And that was what really kind of underwhelmed me about the Knicks sort of free agent class that they brought in. Obviously, you bring in guys like chemistry guys like a DiVincenzo, and there wasn't really like a move to make in this free agent series. I wonder if they're gearing up for something bigger. Like, obviously you have a bunch of serviceable role players on pretty team friendly contracts. Whether that's something that you can try to flip in case a guy like a Pascal Siakam becomes available for a struggling Toronto team, or like a Zach LaVine becomes available if Chicago gets out of the gate slow. I feel like they need to do something, because they didn't do enough, I think, to really move the needle that much from a 47-win team. Like, even when they won 47 games last year, I felt that they were a little bit fluky. I want to see more from Quickly. I want to see more out of a guy like Quentin Grimes. Obviously, these are still really young players, and we know kind of Tibbs' affinity for giving those guys minutes. But I agree with what you said about Julius Randle. he's had the potential to kind of have his own squad. But again, he's kind of a player that I don't know where he goes. You can't play him at center because he's too small and he's not that great defensively. You can't put him out on the wing because he's not that phenomenal of a three-point shooter. And like you said, in the playoffs last year, they had Josh Hart closing games in his place at the four. And that's really what it comes down to. I feel like you need to kind of take a hard look at this roster and decide whether or not Randall or a guy like RJ Barrett are guys that are keeping around. If I had to choose one or the other, obviously RJ still, I think, has the higher ceiling. He's younger. He's on a more team-friendly contract, at least for right now. But, I mean, I look at this team and I don't see the 46 wins that I need to get that over, especially with what other teams have done.
Yeah, I mean, you're probably onto something there, but I still think Brunson is just one of those players, and Tibbs is one of those coaches that just grinds down teams, that he's going to get his wins. Like he's a coach that gets wins. You know, we've seen it historically with him. And he loves focusing on his core guys, and those core guys, I mean, we don't like Julius Randle, but he is a good regular season player and he puts up points. He, you know, he can dominate some smaller teams and stuff like that. And, you know, I don't think it'll lead to any success in the playoffs, but I think a regular season team, I think they are still a really solid regular season team. And not only that, but I mean, you brought up like a guy like Siakam, which is would be a hilarious trade for Julius Randle for Siakam, because they have some similarities in playing type, but Siakam would be a major upgrade. Even though I'm not a big Siakam guy in general, but he is a major upgrade over Julius Randle. So I could totally see them going. I mean, the New York Knicks need to be like actually use their market presence and get like trade for a good player one of these times. They really need this, because the Knicks have been not a good market for, you know, acquiring NBA talent for so long now. And now that they're finally pretty good, I could totally see them making like a trade this season finally, and getting like some decent players in there.
Well, you talk about market appeal, and I want to move on to the next team on our list. I want to talk about the Brooklyn Nets, a team that has been like the hip and trendy team. I've never met a Brooklyn Nets fan. I don't know if they exist. If you are a Brooklyn Nets fan, please DM me.
They don't. They don't exist.
Okay, so we have confirmed that Brooklyn Nets fans don't exist until
I live in the Northeast. They do not exist.
Okay. Well, how are they filling the stadium then? I want to go to Barclays. I want to see them in action. I want them to bring back the Brooklyn Knight. I think it was a phenomenal mascot choice. I think they should have never gotten rid of it. But I do want to talk about this team as they kind of move into the new part of the season here. They're projected to finish fourth in the division. Their over-unders at 37.5. And for a team that finished last season with enough wins to make the playoffs, they ended their season 45-37. You could argue that that was more of a Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving sort of hangover. And as they finished the season, it became pretty apparent that it was. They were a little bit more fraudulent as a playoff team, and I think that got exposed a little bit in that series with the Sixers. But they re-gear. Everyone's a little bit more seasoned. I think Jacques Vaughn is a really great coach. I think he's kind of a coach that you need for a younger team that's not quite ready to compete, but has enough serviceable players to at least be dangerous on a night-to-night basis. But they brought in a lot of unproven guys. They signed Lonnie Walker. They signed Dennis Smith Jr. They signed Harry Giles. They signed Darius Bazley. All four guys flamed out in their initial draft positions, didn't get the play that they needed, not guaranteed to get the play that they might get on the Nets here, at least for the season, but you're bringing in guys who are still young, who still have potential. You don't know what they'd be. It's the mystery box thing. You can take the boat or you can take the mystery box. If you take the mystery box, it might even be a boat. You never know. But they lose enough shooting that gives me a little bit of concern. No more Watanabe. No more Seth Curry. No more Joe Harris. No more Patty Mills. Big locker room guy right there. Where do you see this Nets team going? Is Mikal Bridges the guy who's going to be ready to step up and lead his own team? Or do you see these guys once again kind of contending for the lottery as opposed to their playoff position where they were a year ago?
I am big on the under on Brooklyn this year. I love a lot of their team. I am a huge Cam Johnson guy. I was in college because I'm a UNC fan. And I was, when he got drafted, I was one of the few people that thought that was a good draft choice just because I am a huge fan. I love Mikal Bridges because I just love college basketball, and he was a great college player. And I loved the way he finished the year last year. With that being said, they are going to be a fun defensive team but they are going to lack a lot of scoring. They lost three of their top four shooters. And really, most of those guys were, you know, the top shooters before. Like Cam Johnson, I consider a top four shooter on the team. But the other guys were all top four shooters on their team. They were the 3-point shooters on that team, aside from Cam Johnson, who came late to the team. And I see them really struggling to score against teams. They're going to have to really grind down teams in a defensive battle to actually win these games. Like, you know, guys like DFS, like, hey, if Ben Simmons plays, you know, hopefully he can go back to his former self as a great defender. But I think the only way they're going to be winning games is by grinding teams down defensively. And we see in the NBA these days, a lot of these games are shootouts at this point. And, you know, there's so many offensive teams in the NBA, especially in the East right now, with, you know, even the Sixers and Celtics and Bucks. And I like a team like Indiana and stuff like that to be a better offensive team this year. I just think they're going to really struggle to put up points, and they will finish below 37.5 or whatever it is, 36, 37.5, I think.
Yeah, so I'm kind of in a similar boat. I mean, you look at the roster, and like, it's not a bad roster. Like, I've seen some bad ones as a Wolves fan through those early 2000s, mid-2000s years. I've seen some weird amalgamations of talent. Like, I look at everybody on this roster, and I'm like, there's some guys there. Obviously, look at the draft that they had. They draft a guy like Noah Clowney, a very raw prospect out of Alabama, but can be NBA ready given enough time, given enough reps at that position. They draft a guy, Derek Whitehead, former top five high school recruit who had a kind of a maligned season at Duke where he really, really struggled, whether it was via injury or whether just not living up to that top five recruit potential. He's a guy that I can kind of keep my eye on. When after the trades that went through last year, we saw Cam Thomas absolutely torch opposing teams on defense, but now I feel like he might get buried on the team as well. This is a team that I think is kind of treading water. But if you're looking at this team and you're looking at them trying to find a way to really sort of facilitate their growth and their development, it needs to be focusing on those young guys. And I don't know if we're going to see a situation similar to what happens with what happened to Portland over the past few years when they kind of shut down Dame. They shut down everybody that was kind of a regular contributor to that team, and they just kind of sent all the young guys out to see what happened. I wouldn't be surprised if we saw a similar approach with Brooklyn as we move towards the end of this season. But again, if any Brooklyn Nets fan think I'm wrong, please DM me because I want to know if you're real. Last thought on the Brooklyn Nets. Ben Simmons, he's been in the gym. He's been shooting. We've been posting the videos. We've been seeing him putting in the work. Is this the season that Ben Simmons comes back to great fanfare? Is it his time, Matt Sullivan? Yes or no?
I'm going to say yes. I'm going to go with yes. I think he's. I think because the team has such low stakes.
Stop it.
The team has such low stakes that I feel like this is perfect for him. Perfect. Like, you know, last year he had to deal with, you know, Harden, Kyrie, and Durant. This year, it's Mikal Bridges is the best player on the team. Like, he doesn't have to deal with any of this, like, any of, like, the superstars. He just gets to be his normal, you know, self where he, you know, passes the ball instead of takes layups and is a great defender. And I think he actually is going to play this year. I really do. I don't think he will ever be an offensive weapon in the NBA. I really don't. But he's a great defender, and I totally see him playing on this team. And I think, like I said, they're going to be a fun defensive team with all these players. But boy, are they going to struggle to score, and he's going to be a big reason why if he plays.
I'm honestly floored. I wasn't anticipating you coming in and saying, like, yes, this is Ben Simmons' time to cook. All right, let's do an over-under here. If he plays over under 40 games, which side of that coin are you going towards? Do you think he's going to be a regular season contributor for half the season or more?
I'm going to say under. I'm going to say he's going to play on the team, but I'm going to take the under. I'm not that bold. I'm not that bold.
Okay, so we heard it here first. He's back, but for only less than half the season. Sounds great. I'm here for it. We're back another year.
36 games.
All right, we heard it here. We'll start the timer now. I'll have a running tally going. We'll see how many he makes. Matt Sullivan, 36 games. Speaking of 36 games, we're going to move on to the last team in the division here, the Toronto Raptors. Their over-under is 36.5. So if you think they're going to win as many games as Ben Simmons is going to play this season, according to Matt Sullivan, slam that under. They're plus 4,000 to win the division. They're plus 6,000 to win the conference. They're 150-1 to win the title. That sounds like a sneaky $1 bet on DraftKings for me. They bring in a couple of role players, but ultimately it's the same damn roster as it's been the last few years since they've won the title. They bring in Dennis Schroeder. They bring in Jalen McDaniels. They sign my guy, Grady Dick. Welcome to the team, Grady. I'm trying to figure out a way to get a jersey through customs. I got to reach out to my contacts, but I will be rocking your jersey by the end of the season. Here we go. But they lose a guy like Fred VanVleet, another contender, another piece of that championship team that they let walk away for nothing. What is Toronto's plan? Obviously, they let Nick Nurse go. They signed the new coach. Masai Ujiri apparently still being very aggressive, trying to get everything he can in these trade demands. What is this roster to do? What do you think that the Toronto Raptors need to do to sort of right the ship, potentially get back to the playoffs, something that they were on the verge of last year in the play-in tournament? What do you think they need to solidify themselves as they move into the season here?
I think Masai needs to ease up on the trade demands because they desperately need a trade. That team is a team that desperately needs a trade. They are a funky team. They actually have some really solid players with, you know, OG. I liked Jakob Poeltl quite a bit, actually. But Siakam, I could totally see them flipping Siakam at some point this year and getting some assets, or at least, you know, if the season's going south, I totally actually see them moving on from Siakam this year, or, you know, maybe even OG to a lesser extent. But I really see Siakam going this year at some point. And I think it's going to be because they are not winning games and they're going to go for assets instead, because I don't see them as good. Like, I don't see them in any shape or form as a playoff team, let alone a contender. Like, I just don't think they're a playoff team in my eyes. I'm taking the under on 36 wins. I don't like the roster construction. You know, new coach in the building, you know, they're going to have those new coaching woes. And I just don't see a path for them in the playoffs to get to the playoffs this year. I really don't. I think they're going to be a lottery team. I do like the addition of Jalen McDaniels though, because he, you know, he's a 10-point per game scorer, good, he gets like 1.3 steals a game, and, you know, is a decent defender. I like that. I think they're going to be feisty in some regards, but like, Schroeder is a downgrade. We've all seen the Schroeder experience at some point or another. He is a streaky guy. He has those games where he is absolutely stellar. You know, we saw it in FIBA, we see it in other games in the NBA, but he is not a everyday NBA starting point guard. And VanVleet obviously had a down year last year for himself, you know, wasn't very efficient, but he is still a better player and a better leader than Schroeder is.
So that kind of brings me to my next point. I love the Jalen McDaniels signing too. I mean, it's a headline we've seen a billion times before. Raptors signed 6'9" dude. Perfect. Fits in with the rest of their roster just fine. But I look at their team, and like you said, Schroeder is a little bit of a downgrade. I think this is the year we actually see point Scotty. I mean, it's one of those things that they've kind of experimented with for stints on and off. But when Fred VanVleet was still running the show, that wasn't something they could really do. But like you said, like, you're not going to play Dennis Schroeder upwards of 30, 35 minutes a game. Maybe you are down the stretch. But again, like, your point guards are Dennis Schroeder, Malachi Flynn, who's been kind of maligned since he was drafted, my dude Marquise Noel, my short king from K-State, NBA or NCAA assist record holder for a March Madness game. I love him to death. I don't think he's going to crack the rotation. But you look at those guys, it's point guard Scotty time. Like, if you're going to trot out a weird roster like this, where everybody on your team is a wing, you need to have switchable guys and you need to see the shooting. Where do you think Scotty Barnes's next step needs to be? Obviously, he comes off winning Rookie of the Year, but last season he kind of tripped over his own progress. What do you need to see out of Scotty, and does he kind of help push this team a little bit further than Vegas thinks they can go?
Sure. I'm a huge Scotty Barnes fan in general. I liked him in college, but he really fell flat last year compared, like, in, you know, what you're supposed to do in your second year after a good rookie season. And he really needs to ascend a little bit as a scorer and a facilitator in general, especially if he's going to be playing point more. But I think he can do it, but I can't get over this team. I just don't like the team. I don't like the roster construction. I don't think they're all the pieces fit. I just, I think Scotty Barnes could, if they do end up in the playoffs or even the play-in, it is because Scotty Barnes has taken a leap, and that's what they need. Otherwise, they need to start trading for assets.
So that's the thing too. So like you look at a team like this, and obviously Masai has been very aggressive with how he wants to trade and how he thinks he needs to win every single trade. Like, what trades are you okay losing? Like, are you okay moving off of a guy like Pascal Siakam, a guy who's made all NBA teams, who's made all-star teams, who was a vital piece of your championship run? What kind of trade are you okay losing? Like because I agree with you. Like, I think you need to move off of guys like Siakam, maybe guys like OG. And I know Toronto fans some of them are going to hate this. Some of them might agree with me. I'm not exactly sure where I fall on the spectrum in terms of how they want me to run their team, I suppose. But it's, you got to free up shots for somebody. And I don't, like you said, I don't know who that somebody is. Like, obviously a guy like Gary Trent Jr. averaged 18 points a game over the regular season last year. Is Gary Trent Jr. going to move the needle for you? And obviously they thought they did when they re-signed him, but it's one of those things that kind of stymies me. And you worry about that roster being together for a little bit too long. I think this is the year that they blow it up. But again, like, what trades are you okay losing if you're Toronto?
Yeah. I mean, Siakam has got to go at some point in my eyes. But Gary Trent Jr. is actually an interesting one because he is a bucket getter, but I see him as a lot an empty bucket getter. Just like, they're just kind of, the buckets just go in, but it doesn't really affect the game that much. But there's teams, like there's playoff teams that could really use kind of a microwave bench scorer. Like even the Celtics could really use a guy like him. But I think someone like Gary Trent Jr. would be a great, trade candidate. Siakam, OG. I'm full blow up the Toronto, not to get like KOC on us, but like I think they need to blow it up. I really do. I really think they have such a low ceiling in my eyes.
I'm unsurprised that a big market Boston fan like yourself would once again try to take advantage of a team in desperate need to blow it up. Oh, Gary Trent would be a great Celtic. Oh, that'd be so good for us. Stop it. You've done this enough. You can't keep doing this to people. I knew you would find some way to turn it, but I'm in agreement with you, man. Like, I think Toronto's on the decline. I wouldn't be surprised if they somehow found a way to figure this out, though. I mean, they've got a new head coach, obviously, in Darko Radjakovic, who was a great assistant in Memphis. I think he can try some new stuff. They're definitely going to be one of my teams on League Pass for the start of the season, for sure, just because I want to see what this new guy's going to do. How creative he's going to get. And it's definitely going to be something to document. But like you said, I think either them or Brooklyn is going to finish at the bottom of this division pretty handily. It's just going to be a matter of how they get there. Well, Matt, that kind of wraps up the five teams that I wanted to chat with you about tonight. I want to thank you for coming on. The last thing I want to do here tonight is I'm going to float a little hypothetical for you. And I'm going to start doing this across all of the preview episodes that I do. In some way, shape, or form, I need to find some way for you to, I just need a little bit of closure from my guests. And again, this is a developing segment. I don't know how this is going to go, but we'll figure it out. I have one question for you. Obviously, you're a Boston sports fan. And as a Boston sports fan, you have taken advantage of the Minnesota fan base on multiple occasions. The two that I can think of, obviously the Kevin Garnett trade in 2008. You also stole Big Poppy David Ortiz off of our team many, many years ago. I need you to choose one of these four options. You can take one of our massive ascending players across any of the four sports. You can trade and take away for the next decade Justin Jefferson, Anthony Edwards, Kirill Kaprizov, and for the Twins, I'm going to say Royce Lewis, because that guy hits dingers every time he steps up to the plate, and you need a guy like that on the Red Sox. So of your choice of those four Minnesotan young gun athletes, which one would you take off my teams for the next decade and why, and how are you going to make me hate myself for it?
Okay. So I love Justin Jefferson. As you know, football is my favorite sport. I do not want him, though, because we don't have a quarterback. We don't have anyone that can throw the ball to him. So maybe like next year. Can we do this again next year?
No.
And I'll take Justin Jefferson when we finish like when we finish like third and we get like Drake May, or like if, you know, six and get like Michael Penix or something like that, maybe I'll take Justin Jefferson, but I'm taking Anthony Edwards because he is one of my top 10 favorite players in the NBA. He is such a big personality. He would do so well with Boston media. Boston would die for this kid. Like he is just such an elite personality.
All right. So you've chosen Anthony Edwards, which is the route I thought you were going to take, if I'm going to be brutally honest. Like, and I don't have any scope of how like an NFL trade would work for Justin Jefferson. You need to give me every first round pick for the next millennium if you're going to get him off this team. But make the case for me. Obviously, the finances don't work out. Sell me on the poo-poo platter of picks and players that you would try to give me for Anthony Edwards right now with your current roster. Go.
Oh God, that's so hard. I mean, you have to like give away like everyone. Honestly, Celtics fans are going to hate me, but I would trade Jaylen Brown for Anthony Edwards.
Oh, okay. So
straight up.
make the case. Obviously, the contracts might not work at least just yet, but Jaylen Brown for Anthony Edwards, we would hang up that phone so fucking fast, man.
I know.
So fast.
I think Anthony Edwards will be a better player than Jaylen Brown this year, and Jaylen Brown is the biggest contract in the NBA or whatever, next to Anthony Davis, right? So I don't really know how the money works, but just if I can somehow trade Jaylen Brown for Anthony Edwards, I would do it. I don't know how the money is going to work. I just want to do it if that was ever possible. But I do love Jaylen Brown. I'm not a hater of Jaylen Brown. I really love Jaylen Brown. He's been great for the community. He's a huge person for the Boston community, and he's a great player. He's, you know, Anthony Edwards has a higher ceiling than Jaylen Brown, and we all know it.
You want to know why he has a higher ceiling? Because he can dribble with his freaking left hand. That's what I'm saying.
Did you see that video of Jaylen dribbling with his left hand on Twitter?
He dribbles how I dribble with my left hand, and I was told to not dribble with my left hand ever.
I'm ambidextrous. I dribble better with my left hand than Jaylen Brown. He's a professional basketball player.
All right. Well, in that case, if Peyton Pritchard doesn't work out, we can catch Matthew Sullivan at Celtics tryouts halfway through the season. So we're in good shape. Yeah. Alrighty, everybody. Well, that's going to do it for us here tonight. I appreciate everybody listening. Like I said, this is going to be one of six division preview pods that we'll have up before the start of the season here for you. For myself, for Matt Sullivan, for Steve, Brett, and Mikey, everybody have a great rest of your night. We are less than 3 weeks away from the start of the NBA season, and we are fired up to be here. Have a great day, everybody.
Thank you very much.